You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with award-winning Vermont author Catherine Patterson, whose new novel is My Brigadista Year. Author of more than 30 books, including the award-winning Bridge to Terabithia, Jacob Have I Loved, and The Great Gilly Hopkins, Catherine Patterson is a former National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Her international fame rests not only on her widely acclaimed novels, but also on her efforts to promote literacy in the United States and abroad. A two-time winner of the Newbery Medal and the National Book Award, she has also received numerous other accolades, including the Hans Christian Andersen Award, the Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award, as well as the Vermont Governor's Award for Excellence in the Arts. With her late husband, John Patterson, she co-authored The Flint Heart, a wryly retold fantasy illustrated by John Rocco. In 2000, Catherine Patterson was named a living legend by the Library of Congress. She lives in Barrie, Vermont. Here's some information from the publisher, Candlewick, about her new book, My Brigadista Year. When 13-year-old Laura tells her parents that she wants to join Premier Castro's army of young literacy teachers, her mother screeches to high heaven and her father roars like a lion. Laura has barely been outside of Havana. Why would she throw away her life in a remote shack with no electricity, sleeping on a hammock in somebody else's kitchen? But she's stubborn. Didn't her parents teach her to share what she has with someone in need? Surprisingly, her abuela takes her side, even as she makes her promise to come home if things get too hard. Shining light on a little-known moment in history, Catherine Patterson traces a young teen's coming-of-age journey from a sheltered life to a singular mission, teaching fellow Cubans of all ages to read and write while helping with the work of their daily lives and sharing the dangers posed by the counter-revolutionaries hiding in the hills nearby. Inspired by true accounts, the novel includes an author's note and a timeline of Cuban history. When I spoke with Catherine Patterson last week, I began by asking how she came to learn about Castro's campaign for literacy, and then how she came to write My Brigadista Year. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, it started because I was going to make my second visit to Cuba, and I happened to run into Mary Leahy, of course, you know, Central Leahy's sister,
right?
Who's been working in literacy all her life and is a good friend. And I told her I was going to Cuba, and she said, "Oh, I'm so jealous. Pat gets to go there all the time, and I've never been." And she said, when I started working with adult basic education in Central Vermont, I really tried to take some ideas from the Cuban literacy campaign of 1961. And I said, huh? I'd never heard of the Cuban literacy campaign in 1961. And I don't think I'm the only American who's never heard of it. And so she sent me on Jonathan Kozol's book, Children of the Revolution. And I just became fascinated, you know, that Fidel Castro stands up at the United Nations in the fall of 1960, when he's been in power a year and a half, and he says in 1 year, Cuba is going to become a fully literate nation.
Yeah.
And everybody went, hoo, hoo, hoo. And he came back to Cuba, and he called for volunteers.
Right.
And there were like 750,000 volunteers, and about 108,000 of those were between the ages of 12 and 18.
Wow.
And so more than half were female. So here you've got these sheltered teenage girls from Havana and San Diego to Cuba and the big cities who've been really taken care of by their parents very carefully, so they'll make a proper marriage. And they go out into the mountains in the countryside, and where there's no running water, no plumbing, no electricity, and get water from the river and wash their clothes on the rocks and work in the fields side by side with the peasants. And then at night, under these huge lanterns donated by the Chinese government, they teach the Kemp, she knows how to read and write. And at the end of the year, the UN observers said Cuba is a fully literate nation. And it's, I mean, it's an astounding story. And, of course, it changed the lives of these young women who, as teenagers, had this enormous adventure that made them realize that they were people who could really accomplish something in the world. They didn't have to just sit back and wait until the proper husband came along.
Right.
They could do things. And there's this wonderful documentary that I found called Maestra, which, as you know, is the female version of teacher.
Teacher, right.
About what happened to these women who took part in the campaign, and the fact that they had had this experience turned them into accomplished professional women who could do things for them, for themselves and for other people.
Yeah.
You know, one became world-renowned architect, not in this country, of course, but in Europe, and certainly in Cuba, and they're college professors and urban planners, and my friend, who I found out had been a brigadista, I didn't know it when I first knew her, was a college professor and a writer. So, you know, it was just an amazing assortment of careers that these women knew they could do because they had sort of proven this themselves when they were young teenagers.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the women who stepped up to work in the United States when the men were away at war in World War II. I've just conducted an interview recently about that, and just the way that these women now understood that they could actually be valuable within the country. It's very interesting.
Yes.
Now, your main character is Lola, and she's extremely committed to the campaign and wants to sign up. And I loved this. At the very beginning, you have written for her a very wise, strong abuela to help her get into the campaign, her grandmother. Uh-huh. So I wondered if you had a grandmother like this who was your advocate.
Wouldn't that be nice? I don't think either of my grandmothers thought I would ever turn that well. I had one who felt that it was her work in life to turn me into a nice person. I think she gave up.
Oh, I bet not. Well, let's see. Can you talk a little bit about developing Lola's character and also just generally how you work to know your characters as you write and get to develop them?
Mm-hmm. Well, I always sort of think the question is backwards, is because I feel like rather than developing a character, I'm getting to know a character.
Okay.
So that's why you need more than one draft, because you don't know your character when you start.
Mm-hmm.
You're guessing and you're maybe sort of assigning certain traits to her, but by the time you finish the first draft, you're beginning to know her, and you know better how to show her to the reader by the second draft, and so on and so forth. And so by the end, you feel like she's a friend that you've gotten to know over the course of writing about her. Does that make any sense?
It does.
It's a little pokey to me, but...
No, it does make sense. It makes me wonder what your... it makes me wonder a little bit what your revision process is like. Are you rewriting the whole book every time, or are you mostly tweaking as you look at it again?
Well, I'm going over the whole book another time. There'll be some passages in the book that won't change very much from draft to draft.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, there will be passages that are totally eliminated or vastly expanded,
right?
From time to time.
Okay. Let's see. You grew up in China for part of your youth, and I thought that was very interesting. And I wondered if it made Lola's story even more relatable for you as you wrote about a young girl in a different time and place.
Maybe so. I I've always, because I was born in China and lived there mostly until I was 8 years old, I've always sort of felt like I was on the outside looking in at American life.
Yeah.
So maybe it makes it easier for me to identify someone with someone who has not lived the ordinary suburban middle class American life. I don't, you know, it's hard to know.
Yeah.
Exactly what makes you who you are, but I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't a part of it.
Yeah, yeah, okay. One of the things that you write about in My Brigadista Year is a young man who was one of the very early volunteer literacy teachers named Conrado Benitez. Can you talk a little bit about his story?
Well, he was up in the mountains before the official literacy campaign was proclaimed, and he was already doing literacy, which some of the that was important to Castro even before he took power, that the people that were working with him would know how to read and write.
Right.
And he urged everyone who could read and write to teach someone else how to read and write. And so I'm not absolutely sure how Conrado Benitez happened to be there, whether he was I don't think he was actually a fighter. I've never heard that he was.
Right.
But he was with the early groups who were had stopped fighting and started really doing literacy work.
Yeah.
And so he was killed, I think it was 5th of January of 1961. And so I guess it was Fidel Castro or one of his aides who suggested that the young people who volunteered should bear his name. So that they were named after him.
Okay.
Yeah, there were other brigades besides the Young People's Brigade, but the Young People's Brigade was named after the 18-year-old who died.
Okay.
For the cause.
Yeah. Okay. But I found it very interesting that Lola says, "I wasn't born to be a hero." She says that early on in the story. She doesn't see herself as heroic at all. And yet, at the very beginning, she's very committed to this whole literacy campaign. And she, you know, from the start, is rather heroic in her behavior. So why did you want...
I think she's heroic, but I think most of us do not regard ourselves as heroic. If we do, we're probably in trouble because we don't have the proper fears.
Yeah, okay. So you were just making her humble is basically what that was about.
Well, it wasn't so much humble as much as she knew that she was a person who had fears and she didn't know how hard it would be, but she knew that it was something that would challenge her. And she, you know, the alternative was to live an unchallenged life, wouldn't it? to a certain extent, of just being this protected young woman who didn't really try herself.
Right. Yeah. Another thing that I found fascinating was the depiction of these homes that they were moving into. They were literally moving in and living with these farmers' families. And sometimes these people weren't excited about having these volunteers come and live with them. And also the conditions that they were living in were very different to what they might have been used to. Can you just talk a little bit about your research in that area?
Yeah, if you look at the movies or if you read the stories that the Brigadistas themselves wrote, and one of the great shocks they had was the primitive conditions under which, you know, they had sort of been warned, but they really didn't take it in until they were actually standing in front of these huts.
Right.
And some of the huts didn't even have doors, so they were, you know, they were really sort of shacks in
our
way of thinking. And a couple of rooms, maybe just one room, but a couple of rooms in the house she got. So in some ways, her house was grander than a lot of the houses where the kids were going. And, of course, nobody had a bed or a guest room. So they were provided with hammocks so they could hang them up anywhere in the house there was room.
Yeah, that was interesting that they were, and when they're first up in the mountains and training, they hang their hammocks under the trees, in the trees, and look up at the stars, and it's all very romantic and beautiful. But then when she gets to the farmer's house, it's like, where am I going to put my hammock? It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And it has to be taken down, of course, every day, because there's no room in the house for a hammock.
Right.
People were up and around.
Exactly, yeah. She wasn't going to have her own space. So now, it's interesting. There were a lot of young women that signed up for this. I think it was more than half. So can you talk a little bit about talk a little bit about what the female experience was versus the male experience of doing this work?
Well, of course, they were doing essentially the same work.
Right.
as one of the young teenagers said, for us, menstruation was a challenge.
Oh, yeah.
Which the boys didn't have.
Right.
So in some ways, you know, that made it easier for the boys. And boys in Hispanic cultures have always had a lot more freedom than girls. So that made the experience quite different, because these girls had never had this sense of freedom or responsibility. Which their brothers might have had.
Right.
So, you know, so right there, there is a gender difference in the way they went into the situation. The work they did was not all that different, although in many cases, the women, the female brigadistas did what women were doing, which was bringing the water from the river and scrubbing the laundry on the rocks. But then they still worked in the fields when the women, just like in every culture, the women have
right.
more work than the men.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think some of the women who were assigned to places in the cane fields even cut cane, which is really, really hard work.
Yeah.
They just worked right alongside the people they were living with. And I think that sort of explains why the campesinos began to be open, even the ones who were very suspicious of these city kids coming in and trying to teach them something. I mean, you can just imagine how an old farmer in anywhere would feel if some young kid would come in and say, I'm going to teach you something.
Yeah.
And so it really was a problem of winning these people over and, you know, public relations, of assuring them that they were going to learn as much as they were going to teach. And that was another of Castro's aims in this whole campaign, because there was a great divide between the city people and the country people, and he felt if enough city people went to the country and began to appreciate the lives of the country people, there would be less of a divide between city and country.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Do you, Catherine, do you have strong memories about the events of this time period? The tensions between the U.S. and Cuba is probably what I'm mostly thinking would have been primary to our minds.
Yes, I can remember. I had actually just gotten married when the Cuban missile crisis occurred.
Okay.
And I was going to the hardware store to get something. And it was right at that time when we didn't know what was going to happen, when it was the standoff between Kennedy and the Russians. And I pulled into the parking lot of the hardware store, and I thought, by the time I come out of this store, we may be in World War III.
Yeah.
I was in Japan when the Bay of Pigs occurred.
Okay.
And I remember one of my friends said, well, this is Kennedy's first big goof.
Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting to me that you included in this book some information about that from the Cuban perspective, and how the planes were painted to look like Cuban planes so that they wouldn't be shot down or whatever their capabilities were. That was very interesting.
You know, this is part of the history that we sort of have glossed over. Batista was a horrible dictator, and we've been supporting him for years.
Right.
To Eisenhower's credit, the year before Batista fell, Eisenhower decided we should stop sending weapons to him because he was such a corrupt and awful person.
Yeah.
But still, when Fidel Castro came into power, the United States was so threatened, and I think it was the domino theory, you know, that if Cuba goes, so goes all of Latin America, that made us so frightened.
Right.
Of Fidel. Whereas, you know, we just threw him into the arms of the Soviet Union.
Exactly.
By the way we behaved.
Yeah.
Now, the same with, you know, Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam initially. You know, he was the hero who was throwing off the yoke of colonialism, and we thought he was a great guy, and then suddenly he was communist, and so we had to kill him, or, you know, kill his regime, we thought, and that led to the Vietnam War. So, I love my country, but it doesn't have a spotless history.
No, it doesn't.
When it comes to international relations.
Right. Well, and I think, too, we were also raised to see our country as perfect, which sets it up to fall harder when you realize it wasn't always. So.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Quick interruption to let you know you're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. This is an interview with the award-winning Vermont author Catherine Patterson. If you're enjoying the show, please consider liking it on Facebook, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. Thanks so much. Stay tuned for the rest of the interview.
I have another question about your having written this book, and I was wondering if one of your goals in writing My Brigadista Year might have been to encourage activism or to encourage young people to think about how they can participate in improving their country or in improving their world. Was that a goal for you?
Well, I always say that the writer has no right to tell the reader how to read the book.
Right.
Once you publish it, it belongs to the reader. So that's my line.
Okay.
However, I have a sneaking hope that young people reading this book would realize just what young people can accomplish if they really go about it in a selfless way. I mean, what can I do to better the world in which I live? Better my town, better my nation, better my world. And I think there are young people who do have that idealistic desire. I find it so ironic that early in January of 1961, Fidel Castro asked for volunteers for the literacy campaign. On January the 21st, John F. Kennedy says, "Don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." They were, in essence, saying the same thing, and then they're mortal enemies by April. Just so ironic and so sad.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they both loved their countries and wanted good things for their country.
Yeah, it was very interesting to read this and see a positive depiction of Fidel's early vision. You don't see a lot of books depicting that.
Yeah, it's very sad, and a part of it, I'm sure, is because he was afraid. He had to protect himself, and he had to protect his country, and if you were too noisy talking against it, then into jail you went, or worse. Because he was a dictator, he could do that. But I can't deny that he did really horrible things
right.
in the course of his years there. But, you know, you look at Cuba, and it's got 99% literacy even today. It has free education from preschool through your doctorate, if you're capable of doing that. And it has excellent health care available for every Cuban.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we don't like to hear good things about our enemies, but I think we need to take a second look.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that Mary Leahy had said that she was very mindful of the literacy campaign in Cuba when she was designing teaching programs here. Can you talk a little bit about how one can use what they were doing in another setting?
Yes, and of course, other countries have asked Cuba to help them. There was one thing going in the Cuban campaign, which is not going in most literacy campaigns, which was a help, and that was it was linked to a new day in Cuba. They had thrown off the terrible dictator Batista, and they were going to become a strong nation. And therefore, part of the literacy campaign was teaching the people in the outlying districts who hadn't really been a part of it all what being part of a revolutionary nation was like.
Mm-hmm.
And so the books that they used, you did read the book, the primers were revolutionary propaganda. In essence, so that by the time you finished your primer, you would know what the vision for the country was.
Yeah.
And so in most literacy campaigns, you're not doing that dual
right.
thing. You're just trying to teach people how to read and write. And you're trying to motivate them not for finding out about their nation, but improving their own lives, which is a little bit different. But one thing that Mary Leahy has insisted upon, and since I've been somewhat connected to the literacy campaign in Vermont, is that the teachers be volunteers, and that they be volunteers who have such respect for their students that they go in expecting to learn as much from their students as they teach.
Mm-hmm.
Their students, and this is one thing that the literacy campaign in Cuba insisted upon, that these young people and these whoever was part of the campaign should realize that they were going to learn as much as they were going to teach, and they were not going in as the know-it-alls to teach the poor, benighted peasants. They were going to learn about the life of the peasants and gain true respect for them.
Yeah.
And I just love one quotation I came across from one of the young brigadistas. She said, I taught the campesinos how to read and write, and they taught me how to be a person.
Yeah, that's great. You know, one thing that I've run across again and again and again in doing these interviews is that a lot of writers became writers because they felt isolated because they moved a lot as children and didn't have like a community of friends until they were maybe a little bit older. And I believe that's true for you too. You moved a lot as a child. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Were you aware that a lot of writers have this same history? And if you have any thoughts about that, I would love to talk about it. Why do you suppose so many writers share this history?
I think it's true especially if you're writing for young people, you're writing for the book you wish you had when you were a child.
Right.
You're writing for the friends that you needed when you were a child because your characters become close friends. But I said once that I was sure that somebody who had lived in one place all their growing up years had loving parents and comfortable life, I'm sure they could become a writer. It's just that I think we crazy little mixed up kids have a leg up. And
Yeah, that's great.
So, if you're constantly the outsider, then you're always observing, and that's what a writer has to do, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I wish I have to find this quote because I have wanted to repeat it so many times. But I know Pat Conroy once had this little blurb on the back of a book by Kay Gibbons, and he said that she had the benefit of a terrible childhood or something like that.
Well, I think it was Flannery O'Connor who said anyone who's survived the age of 12 has enough material to write novels for the rest of their lives.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's so true. Catherine, I have to presume you're a big reader, and I'm wondering if you've read anything lately that you would recommend to my listeners.
Okay. How old are your listeners?
They are all ages, but my listeners, a lot of them are writers, so they might be writers of adult fiction, young adult fiction, nonfiction, poetry. It's all different.
I guess the last novel that I read was A Gentleman in Moscow.
Oh, that was wonderful, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
Amor Towles.
I really love that. Yeah. And I'm going to reread it because I think it's the kind of book that bears rereading.
Yeah.
A children's book that I've read recently is called The Wonderling, which is by a writer who wrote a rather remarkable memoir, but this is her first children's book, and it's just come out. And it's so powerful. It has elements of Harry Potter. Not that it's like Harry Potter, but it has that same magical quality of carrying you through in this very imaginative, fantastical world.
Oh, great!
And I'm not a big fantasy fan, but boy, that book won me over. I just thought, wow, this is really great.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Okay, and let's see. I was going to ask, do you know what you're going to be writing next?
Well, I sort of do. I don't usually know at the end of a book what on earth I'm going to do next. I always think, well, that was a good career while it lasted.
A pretty good one, yeah.
I'll never write another book. Yeah, but, I've had a good run, so why should I worry? And that's sort of my attitude. But I've been asked to write a nonfiction sort of biography of Yella Lippman, who is the founder of the International Board of Books for Young People.
Oh, okay.
And she was such an amazing person that I've agreed to do it. I haven't started it yet because I've been mostly just talking about my own book
right
now.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But when I stop this crazy spiral of my life, then I will turn my attention to Yella, who deserves my full attention and not my divided attention.
Right.
I can hardly do more than one thing at once, so I have to focus fully.
Okay.
On her life.
All right, perfect. And Catherine, I just have one last question for you. I was recently told by an agent that as in our contemporary world, it becomes harder and harder to write historical fiction for young adults because you have to make it relevant to their lives and sort of universal because they are very self-oriented right now. And I wondered, first of all, if you agree with that. And secondly, if you have advice for writers who are trying to make history relevant to young American readers.
I've written a good bit of historical fiction, and I'm not really best known for my historical fiction, which makes me a little bit sad because I think some of them are good books. And I'd like for more people to read them. So, you know, I think in a sense, sadly, we have sort of developed into a me nation, and it's everything from advertisements to government is trying to make us more that way. And, you know, the whole sense of the common good seems to have disappeared. I think that's one thing that history helps us with, to see, you look at our founding fathers, and what they were concerned about was the common good.
Mm.
Now, they were imperfect, and they didn't do it properly, and we can criticize them for that, but they did really, as imperfect as they were, lay out a system of government that would be for the common good and not just for a special interest here or a special interest there. Whether it's to the right or to the left doesn't matter. If you're only worried about your little group getting exactly what they want, you can't have a government that works. And that's what we are dealing with right now. We have a government that doesn't work because people aren't saying, I'm concerned about your needs as much as I am about my own.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think history helps us with that. And my good friend Jill Peyton Walsh said, if you want to know what a time in history was like, you don't read the contemporary fiction of that time. You read the historical fiction, because the historical fiction will always be dealing actually with the contemporary problem.
Hmm. Hmm, that's good. I like that.
And so I think maybe in writing about Cuba in 1961, I'm a little concerned about America in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you write historical fiction, it is because whatever it is that's truly troubling you about your own age is coming out